I remember the first staging rehearsal of Jake Heggie and Gene Shear's Moby Dick in 2010. I was the assistant director, and seated beside me was Gene Shear with his score open and his pencil poised. Patrick Summers to my right, and Leonard Folia out on the floor with Jonathan Lamalu and Stephen Costello, talking about the opening moment of the opera, when Greenhorn can't sleep because of Queequeg's praying. The air was charged with excitement, and as Linny looked back to give Maestro Summers a rehearsal number, Jean glanced over at me with a breathless look and said, "Oh my God, it's really happening." This is Words First, Talking Text in Opera. I'm Keturah Stickan. It's the childlike wonder and excitement of discovery, no matter how many shows are under his belt, that makes Gene Shear such an enthusiastic evangelist for opera and an exciting colleague with whom to make work. Over the last week, I've had the pleasure of chatting with Gene a couple of times, and I've cut these conversations together for you today. We talk about his body of work, how he likes to write, and his salad days in Vienna. Take a listen. So, Gene, I'm so glad you're here. It means a lot that you would take the time to chat with me.
I'm delighted to be here.
I actually think this is going to be a hard interview because I know you so well, and it feels strange to ask you questions like you're a stranger. So I'm going to try not to do that, but I'm not a very good extemporaneous speaker, so I do have a script. but you know, I've been thinking about this, that I think being a librettist is a little bit like being an opera director. No one says, "I want to be an opera librettist," when they're seven, and when they're asked, like, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" So I'm just going to ask you, because I think I know the answer to this, but I could be totally wrong. Am I right in saying that you started writing songs, actually, while you're in Europe on tour with Cats?
I wasn't on tour. It was actually before that. I did do Cats. I was at Théâtre de Vienne, which was actually, it was the third production in the world at the time. It started like in 83, 84. I think I joined it in 84, 85.
You know, I found a really old Cats era headshot of yours on a Cats musical fandom site.
Really?
I did. It's amazing. It's an amazing photograph, and it's going to make me really sad that I'm not doing a video podcast right now.
Yeah, that's funny. Anyway, it was a great experience. But I started writing, I was in Europe for a few years before I got Cats. I did a tour of Jesus Christ Superstar, a European tour of that. And also, I actually went over to Vienna originally to study Lieder with Erich Werber at the Hochschule in Wien. Mm-hmm. And so I was still, you know, sort of classically, I was one voice teacher away from sort of getting it together and becoming a classical singer. And so I was studying classical voice through my entire time in Vienna, but I was working in musical theater, and I did Superstar and Man of La Mancha, and those, he was rolling German. And I did wind up doing Cats, which was a great, had a great time doing it, and nothing but great memories of doing it. The show is not my favorite show, but doing it was an incredible experience.
There's such a difference, right? There's such a difference between the value of a show from an audience's point of view and what that value is when you're a performer.
I think that's true, too. I also think you get to know pieces when you do them. It's such a different experience than watching it than doing it.
So how long were you writing songs before you got your first full opera gig, doing an actual libretto for a full opera?
I would say about 12 years, honestly. 12 or no, even longer. Because what happened was I wasn't thinking about writing shows. I was just writing songs. I was writing cabaret songs at first. Mm-hmm. And so what happened to Dora was I was in Vienna for almost 10 years, mostly in Vienna.
Okay.
And So I was writing, I wrote a show based on Measure for Measure, which is with Brad Blake, who is an expat living in Europe. Mm-hmm. Never got done. It was workshop once, but never got done. But so I was working on a theatrical piece at one point along the way. But mostly I was just writing songs. I had no, you know, real great ambition to be a writer. It was just something I was doing, on the side, basically. When I came back to the States, a number of prominent singers, Denise Graves and Renee Fleming and Nathan Gunn started singing songs of mine. And through Nathan, I was able to meet Francesca Zambello, and I had this stack of music to libretti and songs and things to show her. And so when I had my opportunity to meet someone who was in a position to help, I had a lot of material prepared. And Francesca then introduced me to Tobias, and that was Therese Rican for Dallas, which wound up being for Dallas.
So Therese was your first full-length libretto.
It was.
Wow.
It was the first one, yeah.
I remember seeing I saw that four times in the theater when it was in San Diego.
Wow, well, it was they did a good job in San Diego.
They did.
San Diego with it, too. The show really came together there really nicely. And, so that's kind of how it all sort of evolved.
It's really about who you know, isn't it? I mean, it really is about the connections that you make in the business.
It is, but my point is, it is a question of being lucky and connecting, but you also have to be prepared. And I think when I came, when the moment came, I did have stuff to show. You know, I had a complete libretto, I had a complete, 30 or 40 songs to show, and various things. So it's a combination of luck is a big part of it, and also being prepared and working hard.
So as I look down your list and I look at all these composers, your most enduring relationship certainly seems to be with Jake Heggie. And we look at all of the works you've done together. Works like Moby Dick, It's a Wonderful Life, If I Were You, To Hell and Back, Three Decembers, song cycles like A Question of Light, Camille Claudel, Into the Fire. How did the two of you become involved?
Well, we had a common friend, a wonderful mezzo-soprano, Chris Jepsen. And Chris said, you know, you guys should work together. And she was the one who facilitated us connecting. And it was a good thing that she did that because it changed my life. And my relationship with Jake has been, as you said, the most enduring artistic collaboration of my life. It continues now. We're working on a new piece, which I really wish I could tell you about, but it hasn't been announced yet.
Aww.
Big grand opera. It's really exciting. I think it's very current. It's actually set in the 19th century, but it's probably the most current piece in terms of being connected to what's happening in the world.
What goes around comes around, huh?
Never written. Pardon?
What goes around comes around, huh?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
But anyway, Chris suggested that we work together, and Jake was working on an opera at that time. We talked about that, and what we wound up writing was this song cycle for Joyce Castle called Statuesque, and that's where it all began. And it was a great pleasure working with Jake because I immediately understood that we really were singing out of the same hymnal artistically. We're both storytellers at the center, whether it's a song cycle or the operas that we're working on. We're all about telling stories. And, you know, Jake is so incredibly gifted theatrically. And also we both come from a history of songwriting. That's where it began for both of us.
Do you think that that's part of what makes that symbiosis, is that sort of shared or collective history of coming from that space?
I do. I think because what's for both of us, we love singers. We mm-hmm. love putting the human voice at the center of the operatic experience. And you know, Katora, that sounds like that's a self-evident way to go, but it isn't
right.
Necessarily. Because, I mean, a lot of certainly modern pieces, modern libretti, modern operas are very sort of arioso sort of focused, where there's long sections of dialogue that are set to music. And Jake and I are looking for these moments of catharsis, these moments of operatic excellence in which the human voice is the thing that really tells the story. Mm. And that's one of Jake's great gifts as to, for Jake and through Jake, for me, our greatest ambassadors of our work has been the singers themselves. They want to sing Jake's music. And it's been a great way to get my caboose on that train, you can pull it along. So it's been an incredible experience. All the pieces that you've listed, by definition, some are more successful than others, but I'm very proud of the body of work that we've created and that we continue to create. As I said, this new opera that we're working on right now has a spectacular cast, and it's a very moving and interesting story based on true events in the 19th century.
That's great. Can you tell me, do you have a favorite collaboration with Jake?
Well, there are so many different,
I know.
different ones. I mean, certainly Moby Dick was a highlight for both
sure.
of us, because we didn't know how it would be received. And it was, of course, it was received very, very, very in a very positive way, and it continues to be performed. And it's, I'm very proud of the work we did there. It was a big task to take that, large novel and distill it down to an opera.
Absolutely.
I'm proud of what we were able to accomplish there. But there's song cycles, and Into the Fire with Joyce DiDonato was certainly a highlight, working with an artist of that caliber. Mm-hmm. and telling that story, which is such a important story about sort of a woman denied her role in history.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new exhibition that's being planned by the Art Institute of Chicago. I was just contacted by the curator who's doing that, organizing that exhibition. So it's that piece, I think, has had a wonderful life in large measure due to Joyce's incredible performance of the piece.
Absolutely.
We have been so blessed to have these great singers perform these pieces and continue to. Also, I just want to add one more thing, which is that
please,
it's not just the great singers, it's the fact that these song cycles are being done by students in their recitals, both for their bachelor's recitals, their master's recitals, their doctoral recitals. I mean, I'm constantly being contacted by students who ask me about the pieces they're about to perform for a school presentation. And I find that also very gratifying. I think it's just great that these songs are having a life in the voices and the imaginations of all different kinds of singers at all different levels in the journey.
Yes. So going back to talking about creating libretti, you've said about writing libretti, this is specifically with Jake, but I think it applies to your other collaborations as well, that you wanted to, quote, provide Jake with an opportunity to allow music to tell the story. Do you see that as a good job description for yourself?
I do. I think that's certainly how I would describe what a good librettist has to accomplish. For me, music is first and foremost the most important aspect of an operatic experience. That doesn't mean to undersell the importance of a great libretto, the drama that's being told. But we're there for the music. We're there for the music to illuminate the drama. That's the thing that's idiosyncratic to an opera, and that's what a human voice can do so beautifully. When I'm crafting an opera libretto, it's not dissimilar to creating a scenario, at least in my mind, for a silent film.
Ah.
In that case, yeah, because when you think about it, in those cases, the poetry was in the cinematography. There were these, basically these grand gestures, broader gestures because of the nature of a silent film. And then the subtlety and the brilliance of it was in terms of how it was filmed and, of course, played. And it also gave room for the cinematographer to tell the story in pictures. Uh-huh. But we're telling our stories in music. And so when I think of great operas that really resonate for me, while the words are great, it's the structure, it's how it's being told structurally that matters most, because it allows music to tell a story. Rather than talking in abstract terms, I'll give you an example.
Sure.
You think about like the opening of Bohème. A woman comes up the stairs in this to this garret to have her candle lit, and she sees this guy. They're attracted to each other, and before she leaves, she drops the key on the floor, and they both get down on their knees and they are looking for the key, and their hands touch, and of course he sings "Che gelida manina." Now, if without any words, without knowing what they are singing, the words they're singing, you can see that whole thing unfold. And music, even if they were singing it on ooh or ah or humming it, you can imagine that playing. Of mm-hmm. course, then you add beautiful language, meaningful language, and it becomes something that's even greater. But I think that is sort of how I'm looking at each scene that I'm trying to craft. I'm trying to create a musical moment that the composer, he or she, can then, as I say, win the day and allow music to really tell the story. So that's how I, you know, whether it's the opening of Moby Dick with Queequeg, you know, praying, and you can see that Greenhorn, who of course is Ishmael, his sleep is being interrupted by Queequeg. You know, in fact, he's singing a Samoan chant at that moment in the show. So you don't actually know what the words mean, but you know what's happening. You can see it all, and music can then tell the story. So I take my cues from these, you know, great standard rep pieces in which it was done so successfully. I mean, think of the opening of The Marriage of Figaro, a guy measuring the bed and his fiance is saying, "Not here,
right
now."
Right.
You know, it's like, again, without the words, you can tell what's happening, and that's what I. And if you start like that, that gives the room for music to be the primary thing that is communicating, though, as I say, the marrow of the matter, which is the dramatic content that is you know, which you're trying to deliver. If words are the way in which the story is being told exclusively, or you're depending too much on the words to tell the story, that's when you get these operas with too many words.
Yes.
And the music suffers, honestly, because the music is constrained. I mean, I work with many different composers, and they feel, how am I going to set all of these words? You want to distill it down to something that allows music to be the thing that is the most important aspect of the storytelling.
So, with this notion that the words are in service to the music, even though the words are what begins the process, how much do you find that your libretti change once it's been handed over to the composer?
Oh, it does change. I think that what happens is when the composers are writing the scores, if they're open to it, what will happen is that they'll learn more about the characters, they'll learn more about the situations from the music that's being written. The music is telling the composer about who these people are. And as a consequence, you know, new words, new operatic moments can be required. In my experience, honestly, there's more editing, more changes that happen with Jake than with the other composers that I work with.
Interesting.
Because I think Jake is, he's so theatrically minded that he is constantly learning from the characters as he's writing them. But, you know, I'm incredibly proud of the pieces I've written with other people as well.
Of course.
And it depends on the specifics of the piece. So, but I you do change things. And then, of course, you know, in a workshop, things change too. You know, the audience is the final character in this whole experience. So when they come, you learn something about the pieces. I mean, yeah. I've thought that many what times. Listen, sometimes I've discovered it. Sometimes it's too late. You know, it's open night, and I should have. I can see. You can feel. It's not even whether people are applauding or laughing. You can feel the dynamic in the room when people are really connecting to the story, and when they're not. And so, you know, this is a hard art form we're working in, because we don't have previews
right.
like musical theater. And so that part of the experience is you're doing your best, but it's a mixed bag of a different thing. And, you know, we've worked together a lot. Luckily I've gotten to work with you and Lenny and Elaine, you know, a number of times. And
yes.
I think, what is our rule of thumb, that it takes three times?
That's right. It's the third production where we finally figure it all out.
We finally sort of figure it all out. And, you know, it's luckily, like with Moby, I think we were in good shape when it opened. But for those who don't know, it wasn't fully formed until the third production.
That's right. We figured a lot out in Australia, the second production, and it really didn't find its completion until Calgary. That's absolutely true.
2 a.m, and they go, oh my God, I know how to do this, right? I think that's part of the deal too.
Well, and as you mentioned before, I think with opera not having a preview system, it's much harder. I mean, you look at the first city or the first performances, several performances of a piece, really as being previews, because it's the first time you really actually get to see everything put together with an audience.
Right. Yeah. And it's by definition, let's get real, it's a hard art form to get right. Just look at the numbers. I mean, you know, when I started doing this around 1999, 2000 with Tobias, had a wonderful experience with Tobias doing Thérèse Raquin. There were, a few operas each year that were being performed, premieres that were being done. And now there are so many. But again, how many of them are entering the standard rep? How many get done over and over and over again? Very few. And it's part of that is that it's just really hard to get it right.
So we'll get to, I want to ask you about adaptation a little bit later, but just to sort of complete your body of work here. So you've also adapted Charles Frazier's Cold Mountain with Jennifer Higdon, which was 2015 mm-hmm. in Santa Fe. And now, at this point, you're on your second work with Joby Talbot. Everest was your first, also in 2015, and now The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which we will hopefully, cross fingers, get to experience at the Dallas Opera this spring. I'm sure you are, and I just want to say it's so nice to see you coming back to collaborate with Joby after Everest. You know, I saw the final dress rehearsal in Dallas, and I just found that piece to be so brilliant. So I was hoping that the two of you would make something else together.
Well, it's been a great pleasure working with Joby. I really had a great experience with Everest. I think the piece came together beautifully. His score is great. I mean, Joby is a storyteller. I mean, that's what he is. He's just a storyteller with music. He's had a long history writing scores for ballets with Chris Wilden, Covent Garden, and other places. So he's and also a long track record of writing film scores.
Oh, okay.
But he's done lots of Hollywood stuff. But he's a gifted composer, and he's a gifted theater man of the theater. So it's been a great pleasure. And The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, this was not my idea to do it, but I have really embraced it. And it has become a real passion of mine. You know, Keith Cerny, who was running the Dallas Opera at the time and commissioned it, allowed me. They actually gave me the funds to go to. I explained to them, you know, I could, you know, using a novel, of course. But Jean-Dominique Bobby's family is still alive, his kids and mm-hmm. his wife. And so I went to Paris to interview them. And I went to the hospital where Jean-Dominique was being treated on the coast.
Uh-huh.
And I really got to care deeply about these people. And I'm
really excited about the piece. I think it's going to be really something special. And
I've heard a good chunk of the score. I'll be still working on it, but it's quite beautiful, I think, and really excited about it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I'm excited about it as well. I also just want to go back for a bit, and can you talk just a little bit about working with Stephen Stuckey? Was the oratorio August 4th, 1964, was that the only thing that the two of you wrote together?
Yeah, so sad. We were going to do a lot of other things together, and Steve passed away, and
yep. And
we became such good friends, and I was so inspired by Stephen. I'm inspired by a lot of these people I work with. I've gotten the chance to work with really, really gifted and brilliant folks. I mean, Jennifer is an incredibly talented composer,
yes.
And a brilliant woman, and of course, working with Joby and Jake. But Steve was a very special person to me. You know, we became good friends, and my wife and his wife, Kirsten, became good friends as well. It was just such a tragedy that he died so young. We were planning to do, I can say it, it's never going to happen. We were going to do an opera based on Slaughterhouse-Five.
Oh my
and
gosh.
We were well on our way, and then, you know, life intervened. So death intervened.
Yes.
Anyway, he was a great guy. And August 4th was a commission from the Dallas Symphony.
Right.
And Jop van Zweden was the conductor, who's now with New York Phil. As I said to Ben, who commemorate the 100th anniversary of LBJ's birth, so it was in 2008 was their performance. And August 4th, for those who are listening who don't know, was just an interesting day, an important day in history. It was the day that Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman's bodies were found. It was also the day of the Gulf of Tonkin.
Yes.
So when I discovered that, or when I learned it, I said, when I learned about that, it just seemed like a really good way of focusing on this LBJ dealing with this one day in his presidency, in which he confronted the two major issues of his presidency and of his time, really, you know,
right.
Vietnam, of course, and the civil rights movement. And and Steve wrote a beautiful score, and Chris Jepson, who introduced me to Jake, was the mezzo soprano who sang it at Carnegie Hall, and it was one of the last things she did before she passed away. So,
oh wow!
Also very moving. She's also on the recording. So,
uh-huh.
Jop conducted, and it was a special moment to have that piece at Carnegie, to do it with Steve, to do it with Chris, and the Dallas Symphony. They just did a beautiful job of it.
Would you consider that piece a political piece?
Well, I think, it's a political piece.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's...
There are pieces about politics, and then there are pieces that are political, and I'm just curious,
well,
because
I think,
a lot
you know,
of your work it doesn't necessarily fall into that category, but I was struck by August 4th, by how
it sort of
did.
The thing is, Keturah, I mean, I think a lot of the pieces that I've written are political. They're just about personal experiences and personal lives, but they're all caught up in the politics of their time.
Sure.
And the, you know, American Tragedy that I did with Tobias.
Mm.
I mean, it's a very intimate story about this guy, but it's a story of class. It's a story that is, you know, quite frankly, I think feels very, very current right now, because, you know, class struggles and economic disparity and what is the American dream and what is the cost of the American dream. I mean, it's the stories about this young guy and these two women and how he can have this love triangle plays out. But it's really, it's swimming in this whole... of all the issues of the American class struggle. And I think that is, you know, I think with August 4th, I think that is also the case. I mean, we do, you know, it tells the story, but when you're telling the stories of the Goodman family, and it's a personal story, but it's all, you know, it's the story of the country, and Cheney, of course, James Cheney.
Right. Right. And I
spoke with Ben. You know, one thing about that, I got to speak with, it's interesting when you do these projects, I got to speak with David Goodman and Ben Chaney. I got to speak with James Chaney's brother,
uh-huh.
who told me, you know, just incredible stories about what happened from the family's perspective, you know, from Fannie Lee Chaney's, who's one of the characters in the oratorio, perspective. And, you know, and I said to him, I said, you know, Ben, how did you find out that they had discovered your brother on that day? How did you discover it? He said, Gene, you have to understand. He said, you know, all summer, they were dredging various, you know, lakes and streams and such. And they found many bodies of other people that Steve said, who's the other people involved, their hometown newspaper was the New York Times. And they would come up to Fannie Lee Cheney's house and show them the clothing that they had dredged out of these rivers and streams, and said, did this belong to James? Quite as they were trying to find the body, and it didn't until it did, you know, until they actually found the bodies of the three guys
who had
been killed by the KKK.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just, you know, these are amazing, amazing stories. So, I mean, just telling the story sort of emotionally through music I think the whole, it's all political.
I want to change the subject, but not entirely. I actually want to talk about adapting books, and we're talking about speaking from our own voice, but what it takes to then take somebody else's voice and instill your own in it by putting it, by adapting it or distilling it down. I think a large portion of the pieces that you have written, of the libretti that you have written, are adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to talk about that process of adapting versus writing something new. How do you start with a piece that you know you're adapting from an existing work?
Well, I think for starters, I'm looking for the layups. I'm looking for the things that I think are overtly operatic, either of the story sort of writ large or moments in a particular story that are, you know, are sort of overtly operatic. And then I to come back to what I was saying before, I'm looking for ways of using music to deliver the distilled sort of major point of the piece. And by definition, if you're taking a large any novel, it doesn't need to be a large novel. There's just so many more words in whatever novel, but it's certainly a large novel. You have to distill it and cut it down. And find and trust that music will be able to communicate what you've cut. I mean, I'd say, you know, one of the lines I've thought of is that when, you know, in a novel, there is frequently a narrator who's telling the story and it's providing the sinew in between all of the muscles and everything mm-hmm. of the story. And there's not a narrator in an opera, and yet there is, of course, and the narrator is the composer. And he or she is threading together this story, and the stuff that's cut, I'm going to take an example as Moby Dick, the stuff that's cut is then reinvented in musical language. So I like to think that if not the whole story is being communicated, much of the story or the essential aspects of the story are being communicated, but it's almost being distilled into different forms. And then, of course, it extends beyond the music also to the visual components. And I mean, Moby, again, is a great example of that with
sure.
Elaine and Lenny's realization of that piece, which is so, and Robert Brill. A lot of what was not in the libretto, or is in the set design. It's the gestalt of the experience. But as when you're crafting a libretto, coming back to adaptation, you have to give room for these other artists, for this whole Gesamtkunstwerk to come together to communicate the story and not try to hit every point or try to tell too much of the story. I mean, one of the other pieces I'm working on right now, which I also can't mention because it hasn't been announced, is also, it is based on a large novel, and I'm in the process of wrestling it to the ground right now, and just I have to be brutal in terms of how much I'm cutting from this story.
Of course.
Knowing and trusting that the composer and the visual artists who are working on this piece will be able to not point for point, but just the feeling and the essential gifts of the piece, they'll be able to deliver them to the audience.
Gene, I am so happy to talk to you. I always love my conversations with you, so I'm just so honored that you were able to do this with me today. So thank you very much.
My pleasure, and good luck with the podcast.
Thank you.
And I can't wait to get to work with you again.
Likewise.
In a room with you.
Yep, me too. Thank you again.
Okay.
I want to thank Gene again for his generosity and insight. Next week, I'll be speaking with Mark Campbell, another prolific writer of libretti and art songs. Tune in to hear his opinions on Sondheim, how he wrote the libretto for Stonewall in 7 days, and why he believes political issues by themselves don't make good stories, among many other topics. I'm Keturah Stickan. Thank you for listening. This podcast was recorded deep inside my office closet in Knoxville, Tennessee. Special thanks to Early Doucet for the colorful logo, Eileen Downey for the theme music, and my husband for keeping the dog quiet. Thanks for listening, and until the next time, stay safe, wear your mask, and keep telling stories.